The Turk has long been known as the sick man of Europe, and the story of the Ottoman Empire for 100 years has been a tale of gradual dismemberment. Thus, it is no easy matter for us to realize that for centuries the Ottoman power was the terror of the civilized world. It was in 1358 that the Ottomans seized Gallipoli on the Dardanelles and thus obtained their first footing in Europe. They soon made themselves masters of Philippopolis and Adrianople. A crusading army, gathered to drive the Asiatic horde from Europe, was cut to pieces by the Sultan Bayazet at Nicopolis in 1396. On the day after the battle, 10,000 Christian prisoners were massacred before the Sultan, the slaughter going on from daybreak till late in the afternoon. The Turk had become the terror of Europe. Constantinople was taken by Mohammed II in 1453, and the Greek Empire came to an inglorious end. Then, for more than a century, Austrians, Hungarians, and Poles formed a barrier to the advance of the Asiatic power into Central Europe. But the Turks during this century became a maritime power. They had conquered the Crimea and were masters of the Black Sea. They had overrun Greece and most of the islands of the archipelago. They had threatened Venice with their fleets and had for a while a foothold in southern Italy. They took Rhodes from the Knights of St. John, annexed Syria and Egypt, and the Sultan of Constantinople was acknowledged as the Khalifa of Islam, the representative of the Prophet by the Mohammedan states of North Africa, Tripoli, Tunis, and Morocco. In 1526, the victory of Mohacs made the Turks masters of Hungary. They had driven a wedge deep into Europe, and there was danger that their fleets would soon hold the command of the Mediterranean. These fleets were composed chiefly of large galleys, lineal descendants, so to say, of the ancient triremes. There was a row of long oars on either side, but sail power had so far developed that there were also one, two, even three tall masts, each crossed by a long yard that carried a triangular lateen sail. The base of the triangle lay along the yard, and the apex was the lower corner of the triangular sail, which could be hauled over to either side of the ship, one end of the yard being hauled down on the other side. The sail thus lay at an angle with the line of the keel, with one point of the yard high above the masthead, and by carrying the sheet tackle of the point of the sail across the ship and reversing the position of the yard, the galley was put on one tack or the other. Forward, pointing ahead, was a battery of two or more guns, and there was sometimes a second but lighter battery astern, to be used when the galley was escaping from a ship of superior force. Turks in the eastern Mediterranean, Moors in the west, recruited their crews of rowers by capturing Christian ships and raiding Christian villages to carry off captives who could be trained to the oar. This piracy, plundering, and slave hunting went on in the Mediterranean up to the first years of the 19th century, when, after the Turks themselves had long abandoned it, the sea rovers of the Barbary states in the western waters of the inland sea still kept it up, and European nations paid blackmail to the bays of Tripoli, Tunis, and Algiers to secure immunity for their ships and sailors. In the 15th and 16th centuries, no part of the Mediterranean was free from the raid of the Moslem pirates. Such was the peril of the sea that ships used to carry two sets of sails, one white for use by day, the other black, in order to conceal their movements in the darkness. Thousands of Christian slaves were always wearing out their miserable lives in the galleys and prisons of the Mohammedan ports. Isolated expeditions were sometimes made by this or that Christian power for their deliverance. Two religious orders were founded to collect alms for their ransom, to minister to them in their captivity, and to negotiate for their deliverance. But all this was only a mitigation of the evil, and year after year there went on the enslavement of Europeans, men for the galleys, women for the harems. One would have thought that all Europe would have banded itself together to drive back the Turk from the Danube and sweep the corsairs from the Mediterranean. To their honor be it said that successive popes endeavored to arouse the old crusading spirit and band civilized and Christian Europe together for an enterprise that was to the advantage of all, and the neglect of which was a lasting disgrace. But their efforts were long defeated by the mutual quarrels and jealousies and the selfish policy of the European powers. Venice and Genoa long preferred to maintain peace with the sultans in order to have the undisturbed monopoly of the Eastern trade. France was too often the ally of the Turk, thanks to her traditional rivalry with the House of Austria, the rulers of the German Empire. The pressure of Turkish armies on the eastern frontiers of the empire made it impossible for the emperors to use their full strength on the Rhine or in North Italy. Again and again Rome uttered the cry of alarm, and the warning passed unheeded. But at last it was listened to, when a new outburst of aggressive activity on the part of the Turks for a while roused the maritime nations of the Mediterranean from their lethargy, and then a glorious page was added to the story of naval warfare. In the year 1566, Suleiman the Magnificent died. He had conquered at Mohacs and besieged Vienna, enlarged the boundaries of the Ottoman Empire on land, and made its fleets the terror of the Mediterranean. But the year before he died, his pashas had failed disastrously in their attempt on Malta, and his successor, Selim II, whom Ottoman historians surnamed the Drunkard, was reported to be a half-imbecile wretch, devoid of either intelligence or enterprise. So Europe breathed more freely. But while the Drunkard idled in his seraglio by the Golden Horn, the old statesmen, generals, and admirals, whom Suleiman had formed, were still living, and Europe had lulled itself with false hopes of peace. For the sake of their eastern trade interests, the Venetians had as far as possible stood neutral in the wars between Turk and Christian, and had long been in undisturbed possession of Cyprus. For 80 years they had held it under a treaty that recognized certain rights of the Sultan to the island as a dependency of Egypt. They had stood neutral while Suleiman took Rhodes and besieged Malta, though on either occasion the intervention of the Venetian fleet would have been a serious blow to the Ottoman power. The Venetian Senate was therefore disagreeably surprised when an envoy from Constantinople demanded the evacuation of Cyprus and announced that the Sultan intended to exercise his full rights as sovereign of the island. The armaments of the Republic were at a low ebb, but Doge and Senate rejected the Ottoman demand and defied the menace of war that accompanied it. The neutrality of Venice had been the chief obstacle to the efforts of Pius V to form a league of the maritime powers of southern Europe against the common enemy of Christendom. When, therefore, the Venetian ambassadors applied to the Vatican for help, the Pope put the limited resources of his own states at their disposal, and exerted his influence to procure for them help from other countries. Pius saw the possibility of at last forming a league against the Turk, and was statesman enough to perceive that a more effective blow would be struck against them by attacking them on the sea than by gathering a crusading army on the Theiss and the Danube. His own galleys were prepared for service under the orders of Prince Colonna, and a subsidy was sent to Venice from the papal treasury to aid in the equipment of the Venetian fleet. The papal envoys appealed to the Genoese Republic, the Knights of Malta, and the kings of France and Spain to reinforce the fleets of Rome and Venice. But France and Spain were more interested in their own local ambitions and jealousies, and even Philip II gave at first very limited help. With endless difficulty, a fleet of galleys was at last assembled, Maltese, Genoese, Roman, Venetian, united under the command of Colonna. By the time the Christian armament was ready, a larger Turkish fleet had appeared in the waters of Cyprus and landed an army, which, under its protection, began the siege of Nicosia. After long delays, Colonna's fleet reached Suda Bay in Crete and joined a squadron of Venetian galleys kept for guardship duties in Cretan waters. Though Colonna was in nominal command, the fleet was really controlled by a committee of the chiefs of its various squadrons. There were endless councils of war, and it is a trite saying that councils of war do not fight. Prudent caution is oftener the outcome of such debates than daring enterprises. There was a time, in the first days of September, when, if the Suda fleet had gone boldly to the relief of Nicosia, it might have raised the siege, for the Venetian garrison was making such a vigorous defense that in order to press the siege, the Turkish pashas had stripped their fleet of thousands of fighting men to employ them in the trenches. But the golden opportunity passed by, and when at last Colonna took his galleys across to the coast of Asia Minor, Nicosia had fallen, and the Turks had begun the siege of the other Cypriot fortress, Famagusta. Again there were divided councils and pitiful irresolution. The commanders of the various contingents were brave men, veterans of the Mediterranean wars, but the coalition lacked one determined leader who could dominate the rest, decide upon a definite plan of action, and put it into energetic execution. Time was wasted till the bad weather began. Then the various squadrons made their way to the ports where they were to pass the winter. A squadron of the Venetians remained in the Cretan ports. The rest dispersed to the harbors of Italy and the Ionian Islands. The aged pontiff heard with bitter disappointment that nothing had been accomplished. The news might well have made even a younger man lose heart. But with undaunted courage, he devoted himself to forming a more powerful combination for the great effort of the coming summer. It was all important to secure the alliance of the King of Spain, who was also ruler of Naples and Sicily. But it was only after long negotiations and smoothing away of endless jealousies between Spain and Venice that at last the Treaty of the Holy League was signed by the Republic of Venice, the King of Spain, and the Pope, Pius V undertaking to bring in help from the minor princes and republics of Italy and the Knights of Malta. It was proposed that there should be a fleet of 300 ships, of which 200 were to be galleys and 100 navi, that is, full-rigged sailing ships. It was the first time that the sailing ship had been given so important a place in naval projects in the Mediterranean, and this shows the change that was rapidly coming into naval methods. The Allies were jointly to raise a force of 50,000 fighting men, including 500 gunners. Once the treaty was arranged, preparations were pushed forward, but again there were wearisome delays. It was easy enough to build galleys. The arsenal of Venice had once laid a keel at sunrise and launched the galley before sunset. But to recruit the thousands of oarsmen was a longer business. It was not till well into the summer of 1571 that the armada of the Holy League began to assemble at the appointed rendezvous, Messina. Meanwhile, the Turks were pressing the siege of Famagusta, blockading it by land and sea, and sapping slowly up to its walls. The heroic commandant of this place, Antonio Bragadino, a worthy son of Venice, made an active defense, retarding by frequent sorties the progress of the enemy's siege works. By the month of June, the Turks had lost nearly 30,000 men, including those who fell victims to the fever that raged in their camps. Bragadino's garrison had been thinned by the enemy's fire, by sickness, and by semi-starvation, and at the same time the magazines of ammunition were nearly empty. Behind the yawning breaches of the rampart, an inner line of improvised defenses had been erected, and the citadel was still intact. If he had had a little more flour and gunpowder, Bragadino would have held out as stubbornly as ever. But with starving men, empty magazines, and no sign of relief, he had to accept the inevitable. He sent a flag of truce to Mustafa Pasha, the Ottoman general, and relying on the impression made by his stubborn defense, asked for generous terms. Mustafa professed a chivalrous admiration for the heroism of the Venetians. It was agreed that the garrison should march out with the honors of war and be transported under a flag of truce to Crete and there set at liberty. The Ottoman general pledged himself to protect the people of Famagusta and secure for them the free exercise of their religion. The war-worn soldiers marched out. Bragadino, with the Venetian nobles, were received at Mustafa's tent with every mark of honor. But no sooner had the officers been separated from their men, and these divided into small parties, than all were made prisoners, bound, and robbed of all their personal property. The Turks had often shown remorseless cruelty after victory, but they generally observed the terms of a capitulation honorably. Mustafa's conduct was an unexampled case of treachery and barbarity. The Venetian officers were sent on board the Turkish galleys and chained to their oars as slaves. Bragadino saw his officers beheaded before the Pasha's tent. He might have saved his life by becoming a renegade, but he was incapable of such apostasy and treason. The barbarian, in whose power he was, invented new torments for his victim. Bragadino had his ears and nose cut off, and thus mutilated he was paraded round the Turkish army, and then rowed in a boat through the fleet, and everywhere greeted with insult and mockery. Then Mustafa sentenced his prisoner to be flayed alive. The torture had hardly begun when he expired, dying the death of a hero and a martyr. Mustafa sent to Selim the drunkard as trophies of the conquest of Cyprus the heads of the Venetian nobles and the skin of Bragadino stuffed with straw. The news of the fall of Famagusta and the horrors that followed it did not reach the Allied fleet till long after it had sailed from Messina. But even during the period of preparation, there were tidings that might well have inspired the leaders of the League with a new energy. The danger from the east was pressing. In the spring, the Ottoman fleet in the waters of Cyprus had been reinforced with new galleys from the arsenal of Constantinople, and a squadron of Algerine corsairs under the renegade Pasha Ulugh Ali, one of the best of the Turkish admirals. Thus strengthened, the fleet numbered some 250 sail. Even before Famagusta fell, Mustafa detached powerful squadrons which harried the Greek archipelago, and then rounding the capes of the Morea, made prizes of peaceful traders and raided villages along the western shores of Greece and in the Ionian Islands. During the period of the Turkish power, Europe was saved again and again from grave danger, because the Ottoman sultans and the pashas of Barbary never seemed to have grasped the main principles of maritime warfare. They had no wide views. Most of the men who commanded for them on the sea had the spirit of pirates and buccaneers rather than of admirals. They put to sea to harry the trade of the Christian states and to raid their coast villages, and so secure prizes, plunder, and slaves. They frittered away their strength on these minor enterprises. Again and again occasions offered when to concentrate their naval forces for a series of campaigns that would sweep the Christian fleets one by one from the sea would have made them masters of the Mediterranean, placed its commerce and its coasts at their mercy, and opened the way for a career of conquest, but they allowed these opportunities to escape. The peril that menaced European civilization in 1571 was that at last the Muslim powers of the Mediterranean were actually combining their sea forces for a great effort of maritime conquest. Their operations were still delayed by their traditional disposition to indulge in plundering raids, or to wait for the fall of a blockaded fortress, instead of making the destruction of the opposing sea power their first object. If the pashas of Selim's fleet had really understood their business, they might have destroyed the Christian squadrons in detail before they could effect their concentration in the waters of Messina. But the Turkish admirals let the opportunity escape them during the long months when the Holy League was being formed and its fleets made ready for action. That the danger was met by the organization of a united effort to break the Muslim power on the sea was entirely due to the clear-sighted initiative and the persistent energy of the aged Pius V. He had fully realized that the naval campaign of 1570 had been paralyzed by the Christian fleet being directed not by one vigorous will, but by the cautious decisions of a permanent council of war. He insisted on the armament of 1571 being under the direction of one chief, and exercising his right as chief of the League, Pius V had to select the commander of its forces. He named as Captain General of the Christian Armada Don Juan of Austria. Don Juan was then a young soldier, 24 years of age. He was the son of the Emperor Charles V and his mistress, Barbara Blomberg of Ratisbon. His boyhood had been passed, unknown and unacknowledged by his father, in a peasant household in Castile. As a youth, he had been adopted by a noble family of Valladolid. Then Philip II had acknowledged him as his half-brother and given him the rank of a Spanish prince. He studied at Alcala, having for his friends and companions Alexander Farnese, the great captain of future years, and the unfortunate Don Carlos. Don Juan's rank gave him early the opportunity of displaying in high command his marked genius for war. He was employed in expeditions in the Mediterranean and directed the suppression of the Moorish revolt in Granada in 1570. He was then named Capitán General del Mar, High Admiral of the Spanish fleets. young as he was when Pius V appointed him commander-in-chief of the forces of the Holy League, his services by land and sea, as well as his princely rank, gave him the necessary prestige to enable him to command even older generals like Marco Antonio Colonna, the leader of the papal and Italian forces, and the veteran Sebastian Veniero, who directed those of Venice. During the period of concentration, it was Veniero who had the most difficult problem to solve. The Venetian fleet had separated into two divisions at the close of the campaign of 1570. The weaker wintered in the harbors of Crete. The stronger detachment passed the winter at Corfu, in the Ionian Islands. In the early summer of 1571, Veniero took command at Corfu and occupied himself with preparing the fleet for sea and reinforcing it with new galleys from the arsenal of Venice and newly raised drafts of sailors, rowers, and fighting men. Before his preparations were complete, the vanguard of the Turkish armada, continually reinforced from the east, appeared on the western coasts of Greece. To attack them with the force he had at hand would be to court destruction. Ulugh Ali, who commanded the vanguard of the enemy, was perhaps the best hated of the Moslem admirals. A Calabrese fisherman, he had been captured as a young man by one of the Barbary corsairs and spent some miserable years chained as a galley slave at an oar. At last his endurance broke down, and he escaped from his misery by becoming a Mohammedan. Under his new name, he rose rapidly to command, enriched himself by successful piracy, and before long won himself the rank of a pasha and a viceroyalty in North Africa. But, happily for Europe at large, though unfortunately for many a village along the shores of Greece and Illyria, Ulugh Ali as admiral of the Turkish fleets remained still a pirate, with the fixed idea that a plundering cruise was better than a naval campaign. Had the renegade been more admiral than pirate, he had an opportunity of changing the course of history in that early summer of 1571. His fleet cruising off the coasts of Epirus held a central strategic position in relation to the still dispersed Christian fleets. The papal contingents on the western shores of Italy and the Spanish fleets in the ports of the Two Sicilies, or coasting from Spain by the Gulf of Lyons and the Italian shores, were, it is true, beyond his immediate reach. But he could easily lop off one important branch of the Triple League by cutting off the Venetians. The squadron from Crete must pass him to the southward. The more important contingent from Corfu must pass between him and southern Italy in narrow seas, where he could hardly fail to bring it to action, and, if it fought, the chances were he would overwhelm it. Or he might attack it at Corfu, or drive it from the island back upon Venice. If he had good luck, he might hope to be in time even after this to strike a blow also at the Cretan squadron. But he thought only of plundering and burning along the coasts, carrying off crowds of prisoners, some of whom were at once added to his crews of chained rowers. Veniero at Corfu had to steel his heart against entreaties to come to the rescue of the mainland coast population. He could not save them, and he dared not destroy his fleet in a hopeless effort. He must seize the opportunity while the Turks were occupied with their raids to sail unopposed to Messina. He decided even to risk the loss of Corfu. He was acting on the sound principle that in war all minor objects must be sacrificed to the chief end of the campaign. But he could not be sure that in obeying his original orders and taking his fleet to Messina, he was not in another way risking his position, perhaps his life. He was leaving to the Turks the temporary command of the Adriatic. After he left Corfu, they carried fire and sword along the Illyrian coast. There was a panic in Venice, and the city of the lagoons made hasty preparations for defense. But Veniero's action was soon justified. The news that the Christian armada was assembled at Messina alarmed Ulugh Ali into abandoning any further enterprises in the Adriatic, and his squadrons withdrew to join the concentration of the Turkish fleets at the entrance of the Gulf of Corinth. It was not till 23 August that the Spanish prince arrived at Messina, took command of the assembled fleets, and proceeded at once to organize his forces and issued his sailing and battle orders. Nearly 300 ships crowded the harbor of Messina. There were three fleets, the Italian squadrons under the papal admiral Colonna, the Venetian fleet, and the fleet of Philip II formed of the ships of Spain and Naples. The main force of the three fleets was made up of galleys. But there were also six galleasses and some 70 frigates, the former depending chiefly, the latter entirely, on sail power for propulsion. The frigate was, in the following century and almost up to our time, what the cruiser is in the armored navies of today. But in the Mediterranean fleets of the 15th century, the frigata represented only an early type, out of which the frigate of later days was developed. She was a small sailing ship, sometimes a mere yacht, armed only with a few light guns. The frigates were used to convey stores, the swifter among them being often employed as dispatch boats. Depending entirely on the wind, it was not always easy for them to accompany a fleet of galleys. Don Juan gave up the idea of making them part of his fighting fleet. It was still the period of the oar-driven man of war, though the day of sails was close at hand. The six galleasses represented a new type, a link between the oared ships of the past and the sailing fleets of the immediate future. They were heavy, three-masted ships with rounded bows, and their upper works built with an inward curve so that the width across the bulwarks amidships was less than that of the gun deck below. The frames of warships were built on these lines till after Nelson's days. This tumble home of the sides, as it was called, was adopted to bring the weight of the broadside guns nearer the center line of the ship and so lessen the leverage and strain on her framework. The guns had first been fired over the bulwarks, but at a very early date portholes were adopted for them. The galleass had a high forecastle and poop, each with its battery of guns, pointing ahead, astern, and on each side. Other guns were mounted on the broadsides in the waist of the ship, and to command the main deck, in case an enemy's boarders got possession of it, lighter guns were mounted on swivels at the back of the forecastle and on the fore part of the poop. Compared to the low, crowded galley, the galleass was a roomy and much more seaworthy ship. She was generally a slow sailor, but in order to enable her to make some progress, even in calms or against a headwind, and so work with a fleet of galleys, she had a rower's deck, under her main or gun deck, and on each side 12 or 15 oars of enormous length, each worked by several men. She had the drawbacks of most compromises. She could not sail as well as the frigate, and her speed with the oar was much less than that of the galley. But the gain was that she could be used as a floating battery, carrying many more guns than the few pieces mounted in the galley's bows. The galleass's guns were high above the water, and the galleys dreaded their plunging fire. Each of Don Juan's six galleasses carried some 30 guns of various calibers, and to defend their high sides against an attack by boarders, their fighting men were chiefly arquebusiers. In order to fuse the triple fleet of the Allies into one armada, and to avoid the risk of international jealousies, Don Juan proceeded to form his galleys into five squadrons, each made up of ships selected from the three fleets, so that none of these divisions could claim to act only for Rome or Spain or Venice. The organization of the Christian Armada may be thus summed up in tabular form. Division, Vanguard. Commander, Juan de Cardona. Galleys, 7. Main line of battle. Division, left wing. Commander, Agostina Barbarigo. Galleys, 53. Division, center. Commander, Don Juan de Austria. Galleys, 62. Division, right wing. Commander, Giovanni Andrea Doria. Galleys, 50. Division, reserve. Commander, Alvaro de Bazan, Marquis de Santa Cruz. Galleys, 30. Total galleys, 202. Sailing ships. Galleasses, 6. Frigates, 70. Total sailing ships, 76. These frigates sailed during the voyage as a separate squadron under Don Cesar de Avalos. They were employed as storeships and tenders. Total, 202 galleys plus 76 sailing ships, equals 278 ships in all. It is interesting to note that instead of choosing one of the large sailing vessels as his flagship, Don Juan displayed his flag, the standard of the League, from the masthead of the largest of the Spanish galleys, the Reale, a splendid ship built for the Viceroy of Catalonia 3 years before. She had 60 oars, a battery of guns pointing forward through a breastwork in the bow, and another gun on her high poop pointing over her stern, which was adorned with elaborate wood carvings, the work of Vasquez of Seville, one of the most famous sculptors of the day. She had a crew of 300 rowers and 400 fighting men. In the battle line, two other great galleys were to lie to right and left of the Reale, on her starboard, the flagship of Colonna, the papal admiral, and to port that of Veniero, the Venetian, flying the lion banner of St. Mark. Next to these were the galleys of the princes of Parma and Urbino. On the extreme right of the center was the post of the flagship of the Knights of Malta, commanded by the Grand Master Giustiniani. All the galleys of the central squadron flew blue pennons as their distinguishing flag. The vanguard and the right flew green triangular flags. When the line was formed, Cardona and his seven galleys were to take post on the left or inner flank of the right division. Doria, the Genoese admiral, was on the extreme right. The left flew yellow pennons. Its admiral was the Venetian Barbarigo, a veteran of many a hard-fought campaign. Santa Cruz, the admiral of the reserve squadron, was posted in the middle of his line, flying his flag on board the Capitana, or flagship of the Neapolitan squadron. All the flagships had as a distinctive mark a long red pennon at the foremast head. 28,000 fighting men were embarked on the fleet. The Italian soldiers were the most numerous, then came the Spaniards. There were about 2,000 of other nationalities, chiefly Germans. The Venetian galleys were rather short of fighting men, and to remedy this weakness Veniero, though with some reluctance, consented to receive on board of them detachments of Don Juan's Spanish infantry. On almost every ship there were serving a number of young gentlemen volunteers. To give a list of their names and of the commanders of galleasses and galleys and detachments of troops embarked would be to draw up a roll of the historic names of Italy and Spain. Lepanto might well be described as not only the closing battle of crusading days, but the last battle of the age of chivalry. And, strange to say, on board of one of Colonna's galleys, acting as second in command of its fighting men, there was a young Spaniard who was to laugh Europe out of its chivalry, Don Miguel Cervantes Saavedra, author of Don Quixote, some 30 years later. At the end of the first week of September, the fleet was ready for sea, but the start was delayed by bad weather. For several days a storm raged in the Straits of Messina, accompanied by thunder and lightning and torrents of rain. At length, on the 14th, the sky cleared and the sea went down. Next day Don Juan sent off the squadron of frigates under the command of Don Cesar de Avalos, with orders to proceed to Taranto and await the main body of the fleet there. At sunrise on the 16th, the great fleet left Messina. The Reale led the way. The tall galleasses were towed out by the galleys. It took some hours for the whole armada to clear the harbor. Then, on the admiral's signal, they set their sails, and with wind and oar steered southwestward across the straits. The first day's voyage was only a few miles. Don Juan was taking the opportunity of reviewing his fleet and testing his arrangements for its formation. Each captain had his written orders giving his position when underway and in the line of battle. It was in this formation the fleet anchored along the Italian coast beyond Reggio, on a front of 5 miles. Next day the fleet rounded Cape Spartivento, the toe of Italy, and after an attempt to continue the voyage on the 19th, was forced by bad weather to put back and anchor under shelter of the land for some 24 hours. As the weather improved, Don Juan decided not to coast round the gulf by Taranto, but to lay his course from Cape Colonna for Cape Santa Maria, the heel of Italy, and then across the opening of the Adriatic to Corfu. A frigate was sent to inform de Avalos of the change of plans, and the armada, helped by a favoring wind, stood out to sea and for a while lost sight of land. It was known that the Turkish fleet had concentrated in or near the opening of the Gulf of Corinth. It might also have put to sea, and Don Juan took precautions in view of a possible encounter during his voyage. Cardona, with his 7 swift galleys of the vanguard, was directed to keep 20 miles ahead during the daytime, closing in to a distance of only 8 miles at sunset, and increasing the interval again at dawn. The 3 squadrons of the main body appear to have been formed each in line ahead, the leading ships, those of the admirals, at the head of each squadron, with such lateral intervals between the columns that line of battle could be formed by the ships coming up to right and left of their flagships. Santa Cruz with the reserve acted as a rear guard, and was to assist any vessel that might be in difficulties. The rear ship of each squadron was to display a large lantern at the masthead after dark. The admiral's ship was distinguished by three large lanterns. 40 galleys were detached to bring reinforcements of infantry from Taranto and Gallipoli. 4 swift galleys under the command of Gil d'Andrada were sent on in advance to obtain information of the Ottoman fleet. From Cape Santa Maria the course was set for the Ionian Islands. On the morning of 24 September, through the driving rain that accompanied a heavy thunderstorm, the lookouts of the vanguard could distinguish the chain of islands north of Corfu, the islets of Merlera, Fano, and Samothraki, which with the reefs that almost connect them form a natural breakwater. The wind and sea were rising, and the fleet anchored inside the shelter of the islands and reefs. It was not until 26 September that it reached at length the harbor of Corfu. It had taken 10 days to complete a passage that the tourist from Messina to Corfu now covers in a single day. At Corfu, the commandant of the fortress had terrible tales to tell of Ulugh Ali's raid on the island and the horrors that the Turks had perpetrated in the villages, which now presented a scene of ruin and desolation. Gil d'Andrada rejoined the fleet there. He had not seen the Turkish armament, but he had obtained news of it from coasters and fishermen. He estimated from these reports that it was inferior in numbers to the Christian fleet, and he had learned that, as if conscious of its weakness, it had taken shelter well up the Gulf of Corinth, in the Bay of Lepanto. The bay lies eastward of the point where the Gulf contracts into a narrow strait between the castles of Rumelia and the Morea, then held by the Turks. The defenses were of such strength that at the time the strait was popularly known as the Little Dardanelles. It was thought that it would be hopeless for the Allied fleet to attempt to force the passage. 4 days were spent in the waters of Corfu, and 4,000 troops of the garrison were embarked. Gil d'Andrada's 4 galleys had again been sent away to reconnoitre the enemy. On 30 September the weather was fine and the wind favourable, so Don Juan led his fleet from Corfu to the Bay of Gomenizza, 30 miles to the southeast, on the coast of Albania. The galleasses guarded the entrance of the bay, the galleys were moored inside it, bow on to the shore, with their guns thus directed towards it. Working parties were landed under their protection to obtain supplies of wood and water. On 2 October, some Spaniards engaged in the work were surprised and made prisoners by Turkish irregulars, Albanian horsemen, who carried them off to the headquarters of Ali Pasha, the Turkish generalissimo, at Lepanto. Gil d'Andrada rejoined at Gomenizza with news that the Turkish fleet was not more than 200 strong, that pestilence had broken out among its fighting men, and that many of the galleys were undermanned. This encouraged Don Juan to attempt an attack upon it as they lay in the Gulf. But Ali Pasha had also received reports that led him to underrate the strength of the Christian armada, and so induced him to put out to sea in search of it. Twice he had reconnoitred the Allied fleet. Before Don Juan arrived at Messina, Ulugh Ali had sent one of his corsairs, Kara Khoja, to cruise in Sicilian waters. The corsair painted every part of his ship a dead black, and one dark night, under black sails, he slipped into Messina harbor. The utter daring of his enterprise assisted him. Gliding like a ghost about the roadstead, unmarked and unchallenged, he counted galleys, galleasses, and frigates, and brought back an underestimate of the Allied strength, only because the fleet was not yet all assembled. He repeated his exploit while the fleet lay in the waters of Corfu. He could not approach so closely as at Messina, but what he saw led him to believe it was no stronger than when he first reconnoitred it. When Ali Pasha questioned the prisoners taken at Gomenizza, using torture to make them answer him, he thought their admissions confirmed Kara Khoja's reports, so he decided to come out of Lepanto and attack the Allied armada. Thus each fleet believed the other to be inferior in strength, and consequently desired an early engagement. The Turkish fleet was made up of 210 galleys and 64 galliots and smaller craft, 274 sail in all, and its commander, Ali Pasha, was one of the veteran admirals of Suleiman's victorious days. 25,000 soldiers had been embarked under the Seraskier, or general, Pertev Pasha. Ali had organized his fleet in 4 divisions, center, right wing, left wing, and reserve. All the ships had oars as well as sails, and though Ali had no huge floating batteries, like the 6 galleasses of Don Juan's fleet, the Turkish admiral could match the Christians with galley for galley, and have a surplus of 8 galleys and 66 smaller craft. Of these, the 44 galleots were almost as useful as the galleys. Unlike the latter, which had 2 and often 3 masts, the galleot had only 1 and was smaller in size. But the Turkish galleots, mostly belonging to the piratical states of North Africa, were as large as many of the Christian galleys of the second class. They could sail well, and they were manned by crews of fighting men that had a long record of piratical warfare. The organization of Ali's fleet was: main line of battle, division right wing, galleys 54, galleots 2, total 56, division center, galleys 87, galleots 8, total 95, division left wing, galleys 61, galleots 32, total 93, division reserve, galleys 8, galleots 2, smaller craft 20, total 30. Totals: 210 galleys, 44 galleots, 20 smaller craft, total 274. The 50 galleys of the right wing were ships from Egypt, the ports of Asia Minor, and the arsenal of Constantinople, united under the command of Mohammed Chuluk Bey, governor of Alexandria, known among the Christian sailors of the Mediterranean as Mohammed Shirako. The center, commanded by Ali in person, was made up of galleys from Rhodes and the Greek islands, and from Constantinople and Gallipoli, and the Tripolitan squadron under Jafir Aga, governor of Tripoli. The left under Ulugh Ali, the viceroy of Algiers, included ships from Constantinople, Asia Minor, Syria, and the ports of northwest Africa. The reserve, chiefly composed of small craft, was under the command of Murad Dragut of Constantinople. There were a good many Greek and Calabrese renegades among the captains of the galleys, but the Syrians and the mixed Arab race of Alexandria had learned the ways of the sea. Some even of the Turks were good sailors, and the men of Tripoli, Tunis, and Algiers had made the sea their element. The thousands of rowers, who provided the propelling power of the galleys, were for the most part Christian slaves, chained to their heavy oars, by which they slept when the fleet anchored, living a life of weary labor, often half-starved, always badly clothed, so that they suffered from cold and wet. Death was the immediate penalty of any show of insubordination, and the whip of their taskmasters kept them to their work. There were men of all classes among them, sailors taken from prizes, passengers who had the bad luck to be on board captured ships, fishermen and tillers of the soil carried off in coast raids. They were short-lived, for their masters did not spare them, and considered it a more economic policy to work the rowers to the utmost and replace them by other captures when they broke down. The oarsmen of the Allied fleet had also a hard lot, but not as bad as that of Ali Pasha's galley slaves, because in the Christian fleet there was a considerable proportion of men hired for the campaign. But there was also a servile element, Turks taken prisoner in previous campaigns and chained to the oar in reprisal for the treatment of Christian captives by Ottoman commanders, and a considerable number of what we should now call convicts, sentenced to hard labor, a rough lot of murderers, brigands, thieves, and the like. It must be remembered that in most European countries the sentence for such offenses would have been death. The convict galley slaves of Don Juan's fleet were encouraged by the prospect of winning either complete pardon or a remission of part of their sentences if there was a victory, and to enable them to cooperate in winning it, they were told that they would be freed from their chains and armed when the day of battle came. The 25,000 fighting men of Ali Pasha's fleet were chiefly militia. There were only a few thousand of the formidable Janissaries. And among the small arms of the Turkish fleet there were more bows and arrows than muskets. Don Juan had, on the other hand, a considerable number of arquebusiers on his ships. He had the further advantage that while even the largest of the Turkish galleys had only low bulwarks, the galleys of the Allied fleet were provided with pavasades, large bucklers and shields, to be fitted among the bulwarks when clearing for action, and also permanent cross barriers to prevent a raking fire fore and aft. When Ali left the roadstead of Lepanto and brought his fleet out from behind the batteries of the Little Dardanelles, he believed he had such a marked superiority over the Allied fleet that victory was a certainty, and he expected to find Don Juan either at Gomenizza or in the waters of the Ionian Islands. Pertev Pasha and several of the admirals had opposed Ali's decision, and had urged him either to remain at Lepanto or run out of the Gulf, round the Morea, and wait in the Eastern Seas for the campaign of next year. Their reason for this advice was that many of the fighting men were new levies unused to the sea, but Ali's self-confidence made him reject this prudent counsel. On 2 October, Don Juan had made up his mind to leave Gomenizza, enter the Gulf of Corinth, and risk an attack on the passage of the Little Dardanelles. Accordingly, in the afternoon, he gave orders that the fleet should prepare to sail at sunrise next day. During the long delay in the island waters, belated news came that Famagusta had fallen on 18 August, and with the news there was a terrible story of the horrors that had followed the broken capitulation. The news was now 6 weeks old, and this meant that the whole of the enemy's fleet might be concentrated in the Gulf of Corinth. But after the disasters of Cyprus, an attempt must be made to win a victory against all or any odds. At sunrise, the armada streamed out of the bay of Gomenizza and sped southwards with oar and sail. The Gulf of Arta was passed, and the admirals were reminded not of the far-off battle that saw the flight of the Egyptian queen and the epoch-making victory of Augustus Caesar, but of a sea fight in the same waters only a few years ago that had ended in dire disaster to the Christian arms. Then through the hours of darkness the fleet worked its way past the rock-bound shores of Santa Mora, whose cliffs glimmered in the moonlight. The roar of the breakers at their base warned the pilots to give them good sea room. In the gray of the morning the peaks and ridges of Ithaca and Cephalonia rose out of the haze upon the sea, and soon after sunrise the fleet was moving through the narrow strait between the islands. In the strait there were shelter and smooth water. But the wind was rising, backing from northwest to west, and raising a sea outside Cephalonia that sent a heavy swell sweeping round its southern point and into the opening of the Narrows. As the leading ships reached the mouth of the strait, Don Juan did not like the look of the weather, and decided to anchor in the Bay of Fiscardo, a large opening in the Cephalonian shore just inside the strait. For 2 days the fleet lay weather-bound in the bay. During one of these days of storm, Caracoja, the Algerine, tried again to reconnoiter the fleet, but was driven off by the guardships at the entrance of the strait. On 6 October, the wind shifted to the east and the sea began to go down. Don Juan refused to wait any longer. The fleet put to sea, under bare masts, and rowing hard against the wind and through rough water, it worked its way slowly across to the sheltered waters on the mainland coast between it and the islands of Kurzolari. Here the fleet anchored for the night, just outside the opening of the Gulf of Corinth. Not 20 miles away up the gulf lay the Turkish fleet, for Ali had brought it out of the Bay of Lepanto, and anchored in the Bay of Calydon. When the sun rose on the 7th, the wind was still contrary, blowing from the southeast, but at dawn the ships were under way, and moving slowly in long procession between the mainland and the islands that fringe the coast. There was a certain amount of straggling. It was difficult to keep the divisions closed up, and the tall galleasses especially felt the effect of the head wind, and some of the galleys had to assist them by towing. As the ships of the vanguard began to clear the channel between Oxia Island and Cape Scrofa, and the wide expanse of water at the entrance of the Gulf of Corinth opened before them, the lookouts reported several ships hull down on the horizon to the eastward, the sun shining on their white sails, that showed like flecks of cloud on the sea line. The signal was sent back, enemy in sight, for the number of sails told it must be a fleet, and could be none other than that of Ali Pasha. The allied squadrons began to clear for action, and Don Juan displayed for the first time the consecrated banner sent him by Pius V, a large square flag embroidered with the crucifix and the figures of Saints Peter and Paul. It was an anxious time for the Christian admiral. His fleet, now straggling for miles along the coast, had to close up, issue from the channel, round Cape Scrofa, and form in battle array in the open water to the eastward. If the Turks, who had the wind to help them, came up before this complex operation was completed, he risked being beaten in detail. While the fleet was still working its way through the channel, Don Juan had sent one of the Roman pilots, Cecco Pisani, forward in a swift galley to reconnoiter. Pisani landed on Oxia, climbed one of its crags, and from this lofty outlook counted 250 sail in the enemy's fleet, which was coming out along the north shore of the gulf, the three main squadrons abreast, the reserve, astern of them. Returning to the Reale, the pilot gave a guarded report to Don Juan, fearing to discourage the young commander now that battle was inevitable. But to his own admiral, the veteran Colonna, he spoke freely. "Signor," he said, "you must put out all your claws, for it will be a hard fight." Then the wind suddenly fell, and the sea became calm as a lake. The Turks were seen to be furling their now useless sails. The rapidity with which the maneuver was simultaneously executed by hundreds of ships excited the admiration of the Christians. It showed the enemy had well-disciplined and practiced crews. But at the same time, the fact that at a crisis, when every moment gained was priceless, the Turks had lost the fair wind, convinced the Allies that heaven was aiding them, and gave them confidence in the promises of their chaplains, gray-cowled Franciscans and black-robed Dominicans, who were telling them that the prayers of Christendom would assure them a victory. Their young chief, Don Juan, left the Reale and embarked in a swift brigantine, in which he rowed along the forming line of the fleet. Clad in complete armor, he stood in the bow holding up a crucifix. And as he passed each galley, he called on officers and men to spare no effort in the holy cause for which they were about to fight. Then he returned to his post on the poop of the Reale, which was in the center of the line, with several other large galleys grouped around her. As each ship was pulled into her fighting position, the Christian galley slaves were freed from the oar and given weapons with which to fight for the common cause and their own freedom. It was intended that the galleys of the left, center, and right should form one long line, with the six galleasses well out in front of them, two before each division. These were to break the force of the Turkish onset with their cannon. But when the long line of the enemy's galleys came rushing to the onset, Don Juan's battle array was still incomplete. Barbarigo's flagship was on the extreme left under the land. His division had formed upon this mark, dressing by the left, as a soldier would say. The tall galleasses of two gallant brothers, the Venetians Ambrogio and Antonio Bragadino, kinsmen of the hero of Famagusta, lay well out in front of the left division. All the ships had their sails furled and the long yards hauled fore and aft. Don Juan had formed up the center division, two more galleasses out in front, the Reale in the middle of the line, the galleys of Vignero and Colonna to right and left, and two selected galleys lying astern, covering the intervals between them and the flagship. Only a few oars were being used to keep the ships in their stations. So far so good, but the rest of the Allied fleet was still coming up. The reserve was only issuing from the channel behind Cape Scrofa, and Doria was leading the right division into line, with his two galleasses working up astern, where their artillery would be useless. Thus, when the battle began, not much more than half of the Christian armada was actually in line. But for the sudden calm, the position would have been even worse. It was almost noon when the battle began. The first shots were fired by the four galleasses, as the long line of Ottoman galleys came sweeping on into range of their guns. Heavy cannon, such as they carried, were still something of a novelty in naval war, and the Turks had a dread of these tall floating castles that bristled with guns, from which fire, smoke, and iron were now hurled against them. One of the first shots crashed into the deck of Ali Pasha's flagship, scattering destruction as it came. The Turkish line swayed and lost its even array. Some ships hesitated, others crowded together in order to pass clear of the galleasses. Daring captains, who ventured to approach with an idea of boarding them, shrank back under the storm of musketry that burst from their lofty bulwarks. The Turkish fleet surged past the galleasses, broken into confused masses of ships, with wide intervals between each squadron, as a stream is divided by the piles of a bridge. This disarray of the Turkish attack diminished the fire their bow guns could bring to bear on the Christian line, for the leading galleys masked the batteries of those that followed. Along the Allied left and center, lying in even array, bows to the attack, the guns roared out in a heavy cannonade. But then, as the Ottoman bows came rushing through the smoke, and the fleets closed on each other, the guns of the galleys were silent. For a few moments the fight had been like a modern battle, with hundreds of guns thundering over the sea. Now it was a fight like Salamis or Actium, except for the sharp reports of musketry in the melee and the cannon of the galleasses making the Turkish galleys their mark when they could fire into the mass without danger to their friends. The first to meet in close conflict were Barbarigo's division on the Allied left and Mohammed Scirocco's squadron, which was opposed to it on the Turkish right. The Egyptian Pasha brought his own galley into action on the extreme flank bow to bow with the Venetian flagship, and some of the lighter Turkish galleys, by working through the shallows between Barbarigo and the land, were able to fall on the rear of the extreme left of the line, while the larger galleys pressed the attack in front. The Venetian flagship was rushed by a boarding party of Janissaries, and her decks cleared as far as the mainmast. Barbarigo, fighting with his visor open, was mortally wounded with an arrow in his face, and was carried below. But his nephew, Contarini, restored the fight, and with the help of reinforcements from the next galley, drove the boarders from the decks of the flagship. Contarini was mortally wounded in the midst of his success, but two of his comrades, Nani and Porcia, led a rush of Venetians and Spaniards onto Mohammed Scirocco's flagship, whose decks were swept by the fire of the arquebusiers before the charge of swords and pikes burst over her bows. The onset was irresistible. The Turks were cut down, stabbed, hurled overboard, Mohammed himself being killed in the melee. By the time the great galley of Alexandria was thus captured, the landward wings of the two fleets were mingled together in a confused fight, in which there was little left of the original order. There was more trace of a line on the Allied or Christian side. The Turks had not broken through them, but they had swung round, somewhat forcing Mohammed's galleys toward the shore. When the standard of the Egyptian admiral was hauled down by the victorious Venetians, and the rowers suddenly ceased to be slaves and fraternized with the conquerors, some of the captains on the Turkish right lost heart, drove their galleys aground in the shallows, and deserted them for the shore, where they hoped to find refuge among friends. On Don Juan's left, though the fighting continued in a fierce melee of ships locked together, and with crews doing wild work with loud arquebus and clashing sword, the battle was practically won. Meanwhile, there had been close and deadly fighting in the center. The main squadron of the Turks had, like their right division, suffered from the fire of the advanced galleasses. Several shots had struck the huge galley that flew the flag of the Capitan Pasha, Ali, a white pennon sent from Mecca, embroidered in gold with verses of the Quran. Ali steered straight for the center of the Christian line, where the group of large galleys, the Reale with the embroidered standard of the Holy League, Colonna's ship with its ensign of the papal keys, and Veniero's with the lion flag of St. Mark, told him he was striking at the heart of the Confederacy. He chose Don Juan's Reale for his adversary, relying on the Seraskier Pertev Pasha and the Pasha of Mitylene on his left and right to support him by attacking the other two flagships. Ali held the fire of his bow guns till he was within a short musket shot of his enemy, and then fired at point blank. One of his cannonballs crashed through the bow barrier of the Reale and raked the rowers' benches, killing several oarsmen. As the guns of the Reale thundered out their reply, the bow of the Turkish flagship, towering over the forecastle of Don Juan's vessel, came through the smoke cloud and struck the Spanish ship stern to stern with a grinding crash and a splintering of timber, throwing down many of the crew. The Turkish bow dug deep into the Spanish ship, and in the confusion of the collision it was thought for a moment she was sinking, but a forward bulkhead kept her afloat. Ali's ship rebounded from the shock, then glided alongside the Reale, with much mutual smashing of oars. The two ships grappled, and the hand-to-hand fight began. At the same time, Pertev Pasha grappled Veniero's flagship, and another Turkish galley, commanded by Ali's two sons, forced its way through the line and engaged the two galleys that lay astern of the flagship. Then the Pasha of Mitylene closed upon Colonna's ship, and all along the center the galleys came dashing together. The crash of broken oars, the rattling explosions of arquebuses and grenades, the war notes of the Christian trumpets and the Turkish drums, the clash of swords, the shouts and yells of the combatants rose in a deafening din. Froissart wrote in an earlier day that sea fights were always murderous. This last great battle of the medieval navies had the character of its predecessors. In this fight, at close quarters on the narrow space afforded by the galley's decks, there was no question of surrender on either side, no thought but of which could strike the hardest and kill the most. Nor could men, striving hand to hand in the confusion of the floating melee, know anything of what was being done beyond their limited range of view, so that even the admirals became for the moment only leaders of small groups of fighting men. On the poop and forecastle of the Reale were gathered men whose names recalled all that was greatest in the annals of Spanish chivalry, veterans who had fought the Moor and voyaged the Western Ocean, and young cavaliers eager to show themselves worthy sons of the lines of Guzman and Mendoza, Benavides and Salazar. Don Juan, arrayed in complete steel, stood by the flagstaff of the consecrated standard. Along the bulwarks, 400 Castilian arquebusiers in corselet and headpiece represented the pick of the yet unconquered Spanish infantry. The 300 rowers had left the oars, and, armed with pike and sword, were ready to second them, when the musketry ceased and the storming of the Turkish galleys began. From Ali's ship, 100 archers and 300 musketeers of the Janissary corps replied to the fire of the Spaniards. The range was a few feet. Men were firing in each other's faces, and at such close quarters the arquebus with its heavy ball was a more death-dealing weapon than the modern rifle. Such slaughter could not last, and the caballeros were eager to end it by closing on the Turks with cold steel. Twice they dashed through the smoke over Ali's bulwarks, and for a while gained a footing on the deck of the enemy's flagship. Twice they were driven back by the reinforcements that Ali drew from the crews of galleys that had crowded to his aid. Then the Turks came clambering over the bows of the Reale, and nearly cleared the forecastle. Don Bernardino de Cardenas brought up a reserve from the waist of the ship and attacked the Turkish boarders in the bows. He was struck by a musket ball. It dented his steel helmet, but failed to penetrate. Cardenas fell, stunned by the shock of the blow, and died next day, though he showed no sign of a wound. Don Juan himself was going forward, sword in hand, to assist in the fight in the bows of the Reale, and Ali was hurrying up reinforcements to the attack. It was a critical moment, but Colonna just then struck a decisive blow. He had boarded and stormed the ship that attacked him, a long galley commanded by the Bey of Negropont. Having thus disposed of his immediate adversary, he saw the peril of the Reale. Manning all his oars, he drove the bow of his flagship deep into the stern of Ali's ship, swept her decks with a volley of musketry, and sent a storming party on to her poop. The diversion saved the Reale. The Spaniards hustled the Turks over her bows at point of pike, and Ali, attacked on two sides, had now to fight on the defensive. On the other side of the Reale, Vinero's flagship was making a splendid fight. It is the details of those old battles that bring home to us the changes of three centuries. A modern admiral stands sheltered in his conning tower, amid voice tubes and electrical transmitters. Vinero, a veteran of 70 years, stood by the poop rail of his galley, thinking less of commanding than of doing his own share of the killing. Balls and arrows whistled around him. Along the bulwarks amidships, his men were fighting hand to hand with the Seraskier's galley that lay lashed alongside. There were no orders to give for the moment, so he occupied himself with firing a blunderbuss into the crowd on the Turkish deck, and handing it to a servant to reload with half a dozen balls, and then firing again and again. Here, too, in the main squadron, were fighting the galleys of Spinola of Genoa, of the young Duke of Urbino, of the Prince of Parma, of Bonelli, the nephew of Pius V, of Sforza of Milan, and Gonzaga of Solferino, and the young heirs of the Roman houses of Colonna and Orsini. Venice had not all the glory of Lepanto, and Italy still remembers that every noble family, every famous city, from the Alps to Sicily, had its part in the battle. Colonna's timely aid to the Reale was the turning point of the fight in the center. Led by Vasquez Coronada and Gil de Andrada, the Spanish infantry poured into Ali's ship, and winning their way foot by foot, cleared her decks. Not one of her 400 fighting men survived. Ali himself was one of the last to fall. One account says that when all was lost, he cut his throat with his dagger, another that he was shot down at close quarters. His head was cut off, placed on a pike, and carried to Don Juan with the captured standard of Mecca. The chivalrous young admiral turned with disgust from the sight of the blood-dripping head and ordered it to be thrown into the sea. The battle had lasted an hour and a half. Don Juan saw in the capture of the enemy's flagship the assurance of victory. Like all great commanders, he knew the value of moral effect. He hoisted the consecrated banner of the League at the tall masthead of the conquered galley, and bade his trumpeters blow a flourish and his men shout victory. In the confusion and uproar of the melee, not many of the ships would see what was happening round the Reale, but this demonstration would attract the attention of friends and foes in the center of the fight. It was just one of the moments when, both parties becoming exhausted by the prolonged struggle, success would belong to the side that could put forth even for a while the more vigorous effort, and the sight of the papal standard fluttering from the Turkish mast instead of the banner of Mecca inspired this effort on the part of the Christians, and depressed and discouraged their adversaries. Pertev Pasha had lost heavily under the fire of the Venetian flagship, and had failed in an effort to board her. He cut his galley adrift. Veniero let her go, and turned to attack other enemies. Pertev's ship drifted down on two Christian galleys, and was promptly boarded and taken. The Seraskier slipped on board of a small craft he was towing astern, reached another ship, and giving up all hope of victory, fled with her from the fight. Veniero had meanwhile rammed and sunk two other galleys. He was wounded with a bullet in the leg, but he had the wound bandaged and remained on deck. The old man gave Venice good reason to be proud of her admiral. Along the left and center of the Christian armada there was now victory. Admirals and captains were busy storming or sinking such of the enemy's ships as still maintained the fight. On the left, Barbarigo had been mortally wounded, and the losses had been heavy, but the success was so pronounced that large numbers of men had been landed to hunt down the Turkish fugitives on the shore. In the center there was still some hard fighting. Here it was that Miguel Cervantes, leading the stormers to the capture of a Turkish galley, received three wounds, one of which cost him his left hand. When the battle began at noon, first on the Allied left, then in the center, Doria, the Genoese admiral who commanded the right, was not yet in position. His orders were to mark with his flagship the extreme right of the line of battle, so that the rest of his division could form on that point. But it was soon seen that he was keeping away, steering southward into the open sea, with his division trailing after him in a long line, the galleasses that should have been out in front coming slowly up behind the squadron. Ulugh Ali, with the left wing of the Turkish fleet, had also altered his course, and was steering on a parallel line to that taken by the Genoese. Some of the Christian captains who watched these movements from the right center thought that Doria was deserting the armada, and even that he was in flight, pursued by Ulugh Ali. Doria afterwards explained that, as he steered out from behind the center to take up his position in the battle line, he saw that Ulugh Ali, instead of forming on Ali Pasha's flank, was working out to seaward, and he therefore believed that the Algerine was trying to get upon the flank of the Allied line, in order to envelop it and attack from both front and rear, so as to crush the extreme right with a local superiority of force. His plan was, therefore, to confine himself to observing Ulugh Ali's movements, steering on a parallel course in the hope of eventually closing and meeting him fairly ship to ship. Doria was an old sailor, perhaps the most experienced leader in the fleet, except the veteran Veniero. If he had been less of a tactician, perhaps he would have come into action sooner. And it is strange that, while playing for position against Ulugh Ali, he did not realize that if, instead of continually increasing his own distance from the center, he had at any moment turned back towards it, he could thus force the Algerine admiral either to close with him or leave him free to overwhelm the Turkish main squadron by enveloping its left. It was Ulugh Ali, not Doria, who turned back and ventured on a stroke like this. The Algerine had, after all, outmaneuvered the over-clever Genoese. The course taken by the two squadrons had, with the drift of the current, placed Ulugh Ali's rearmost ships actually somewhat nearer the seaward flank of the main fighting lines than Doria's galleys, which his squadron also outnumbered. A signal ran down the long line of the Turkish left, and while some of the galleys turned and bore down on Doria's division, the rest swung round, and, before Doria had quite realized what was happening, Ulugh Ali, with the heaviest ships of his division, was rushing towards the fight in the center. The brunt of the Algerine's onset fell upon a dozen galleys on Don Juan's right flank. The furthest out, the flagship of the Knights of Malta, was attacked by seven of the enemy's vessels. Next to her lay the papal galley Fiorenza, the Piedmontese Margherita di Savoia, and seven or eight Venetian ships. All these were enveloped in the Turkish attack which engaged the line in front, flank, and rear. There were no enemies the Algerines hated so fiercely as the Knights of Malta, but, even though they had the flagship of the order at such a fearful disadvantage, they did not venture to close with it until they had overwhelmed the knights and their crew with a murderous fire of bullets and arrows at close quarters. Then they boarded the ship and disposed of the few surviving defenders. The commander, Giustiniani, wounded by 5 arrows, and a Sicilian and a Spanish knight alone survived, and these only because they were left for dead among the heaps of slain that encumbered the deck. Ulugh Ali secured as a trophy of his success the standard of the knights. In the same way, the Fiorenza and the San Giovanni of the Papal Squadron and the Piedmontese ship were rushed in rapid succession. On the Fiorenza, the only survivors were her captain, Tommaso de' Medici, and 16 men, all wounded. The captain of the San Giovanni was killed with most of his men, and the captain of the Savoyard ship survived an equally terrible slaughter after receiving no less than 11 wounds. But Ulugh Ali was not to be allowed to eat up the line ship by ship. Reinforcements were now arriving in rapid succession. First Santa Cruz, with the reserve, dashed into the fight, and though twice wounded with shot from a Turkish arquebus, drove his flagship into the midst of the Algerines. Don Juan cut adrift a captured ship he had just taken in tow, and with 12 galleys hastened to assist the reserve in restoring the fight. Doria, leaving part of his division to encounter the galleys Ulugh Ali had detached against it, led the rest into the melee. Colonna and Vignero were supporting Don Juan. The local advantage of numbers, which Ulugh Ali at first possessed, soon disappeared, but for more than an hour the fight continued, with heavy loss on both sides. Then the Algerine admiral struggled out of the melee, and with 14 ships fled northwestward, steering for Cape Oxia and the wide channel between Ithaca and the mainland. Santa Cruz and Doria pursued for a while, but a wind sprang up from the southeast, and the fugitives set their long lateen sails. Under sail and oar, a corsair could generally defy pursuit. The pursuers gave up the chase and returned to where Don Juan and the other admirals were securing their prizes, clearing the decks of dead, collecting the wounded, and hurriedly repairing damages. It was now after 4 o'clock, and less than 3 hours of daylight remained for these operations. Besides the handful that had escaped with Ulugh Ali, a few galleys had got away into the Gulf of Corinth, making for Lepanto, but the great Turkish armada had been destroyed, and the victorious armament was mistress of the Mediterranean. The success had been dearly bought. On both sides, the losses in the hard-fought battle had been terrible. The Allies had about 7,500 men killed or drowned, 2/3 of these fighting men, the rest rowers. The nobles and knights had exposed themselves freely in the melee, and Spain, Malta, Venice, and the Italian cities had each, and all, their role of heroic dead. The list of the Venetians begins with the names of 17 captains of ships, including the Admiral Barbarigo, besides 12 other chiefs of great houses who fought under the standard of St. Mark in command of companies of fighting men. No less than 60 of the Knights of St. John gave their lives that day for the cause of Christ, to quote the annalist of the order. Several others were wounded, and of these the prior Giustiniani and his captain, Naro of Syracuse, died soon after. One of the knights killed in the battle was a Frenchman, Raymond de Loubière, a Provençal. Another Frenchman, the veteran de Romegas, fought beside Don Juan on the Reale, and to his counsel and aid the commander-in-chief attributed much of his success in the campaign. The long lists of the Spanish, Neapolitan, Roman, and Genoese nobles who fell at Lepanto include many historic names. The losses of the defeated Moslems were still heavier. The lowest estimate makes the number of the dead 20,000, the highest 30,000. Ali Pasha and most of his captains were killed. Ali's 2 sons and several of his best officers were among the prisoners. 15 Turkish galleys were sunk or burned. No less than 190 ships were the prizes of the victors. A few galleys had escaped by the Little Dardanelles to Lepanto. A dozen more had found refuge with Ulugh Ali in the fortified harbor of Santa Mora. The Algerine eventually reached Constantinople and laid at the feet of Sultan Selim the standard of the Knights of Malta, which he had secured when he was in temporary possession of Giustiniani's flagship. Don Juan's best trophies of victory were the 12,000 Christian slaves found on board the captured galleys. They were men of all nations, and some of them had for years toiled at the oar. Freed from their bondage, they carried throughout all Christendom the news of the victory and the fame of their deliverer. Hardly 3 hours of daylight remained when the battle ended, and the Christian admirals reluctantly abandoned the pursuit of Ulugh Ali. The breeze that had aided the Algerine in his flight was rapidly increasing to a gale, and the sea was rising fast. The Christian fleet, encumbered with nearly 200 prizes, and crippled by the loss of thousands of oars shattered in the fight, was in serious danger in the exposed waters that had been the scene of the battle. By strenuous and well-directed efforts, the crews of oarsmen were hurriedly reorganized. Happily, the wind was favorable for a run through the Oxia Channel to the Bay of Patala. The prizes were taken in tow. Sails were set. Weary men tugged at the oar, knights and nobles taking their places among them. As the October night deepened into darkness, amid driving rain and roaring wind squalls, the fleet anchored in the sheltered bay. The gale that swept the Adriatic was a warning that the season for active operations was drawing to a close, and the admirals reluctantly decided that no more could be done till next spring. The swiftest ships were sent off to carry the good news of Lepanto to Rome and Messina, Venice and Genoa, Naples and Barcelona. The fleet returned in triumph to Messina, and entered the port trailing the captured Turkish standards in the water astern of the ships that had taken them, while pealing bells and saluting cannon greeted the victors. Lepanto worthily closed the long history of the oar-driven navies. The galleasses, with their tall masts and great sails, and their bristling batteries of cannon, which lay in front of Don Juan's battle line, represented the new type of ship that was soon to alter the whole aspect of naval war. So quickly came the change that men who had fought at Lepanto were present, only 17 years later, at another world-famed battle that was fought under sail, the defeat of King Philip's Grand Armada in the narrow seas of the North.